From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. In a little more than 3 weeks, Pittsburgh voters will select the Democratic nominee for mayor. There are two challengers to incumbent Bill Peduto.
I think over the course of the past 3 years plus, we've been able to show that we can make a city government that is catching up with all of the great things that are happening in the city.
But what kind of campaigns have Darlene Harris and John Welsh been running? It's been a year since Pennsylvania legalized medical marijuana, but 12 months later, how's that process going? And are doctors buying in?
We do not have much science in many conditions that medical marijuana is advocated for.
And more than 5 years after the demolition of the Civic Arena, detailed plans were unveiled this week for the first phase of development of that site. We'll discuss all that on The Confluence following this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up a little later, it's been a year since Pennsylvania legalized medical marijuana. Is the state on track for the production and distribution of medical cannabis? But first, on May 16th, Pittsburghers will select the Democratic nominee for mayor. And if an 80-plus year tradition holds, the mayor. With just 25 days remaining before the primary, we thought we'd check on the campaign for mayor with Chris Potter, who covers politics for the Post-Gazette, and his colleague, reporter Adam Smeltz. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much for having us.
And if you have a comment or question, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay, after last year's raucous presidential campaign, any election following that is going to appear to be understated or overshadowed. But has there been a campaign for mayor? We have three Democrats on the ballot. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a campaign in the sense that Mayor Peduto has aired his first TV ad. There have been a couple of debates and forums. But it is very difficult in the city of Pittsburgh to defeat an incumbent. Conventional wisdom would tell you we have two challengers, which makes it a little even harder because you're splitting the vote.
You're splitting the anti-incumbent
vote. Yeah, right. Exactly. So, but I think there's been an interesting discussion of some issues. The mayor has been challenged on affordable housing in particular, and the situation at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, which Adam is better equipped to speak about than I am for sure. But there are issues being discussed. Darlene Harris, the city councilwoman, is running sort of a campaign almost in an abstract sense. There aren't a lot of lawn signs. She hasn't held a lot of rallies. She never really even had a formal campaign kickoff. But Reverend John Welch, a minister who's a longtime fixture in the community here, is running sort of the trappings of a familiar campaign. There are rallies, there are T-shirts, and both of them are trying to bring the fight to the mayor.
Yeah. And likewise, the mayor has made clear that he sees this as a real challenge, that he sees a legitimate race. He said on, I think it was Wednesday night after a debate at WTAE, he said, he sees concern that he might not win the nomination in a few weeks. And he said he's mounting a fully fledged, fully operational campaign to make sure that he holds on to his seat.
Yeah, that said, I mean, he will be spending his campaign has told me $100,000 on this ad, which people have seen up. The ad itself doesn't even mention his rivals. It mentions Donald Trump. You'd almost think he's taking on the president. And that's politically smart. You don't want to, if you mention your rivals, a lot of people may not have even heard of John Welch, for example. So why why give him the attention? But it's a $100,000 buy. That's more than either of his rivals is likely to raise in this entire season put together. So I think you really do get a sense. The old saying is, if you're not running unopposed, run scared. And I think the mayor is taking that advice to heart. But he has all of the advantages in this race.
Yeah, and it's smart because there is probably enough in this city of Pittsburgh with the Democratic voter registration edge. There's probably enough anti-Trump sentiment that would play to.
Yeah, and the mayor himself has actually invoked the T word a number of times. Again, going back to Wednesday, he said, I never would have guessed. I think he said, never in 1,000 years would I have guessed that Donald Trump would win the White House. And look who's in the White House now. That was part of his explanation when he was asked, do you have any concern that you might not win this nomination next month? So
Do we, do either Reverend Walsh or Councilwoman Harris have resources to even run their own ads, though?
Well, it's difficult to say what resources Councilwoman Harris has. She has not followed a city ordinance requiring monthly disclosure of campaign finance activity. She was questioned about that on during the Wednesday debate, and basically told me, I was the guy questioning her, to basically pound sand until she filed a state-required report a couple weeks from now. So it's hard to say what kind of resources she has. Reverend Welch has raised, I'm blanking on the exact number, in the ballpark of about $20,000, $25,000. He has, again, he's made a show of it. There are T-shirts, there are lawn signs. I've seen them around. They have resources, but are you going to see either of these folks on TV? I would be very much surprised.
Okay. So I talked with Councilwoman Harris a few weeks ago and asked her what she thought the key issue is.
I think that you should be a full-time mayor, that you should be in the city taking care of business, not just traveling. And I really don't believe that the people have had a full-time mayor here.
Is this, did she just tell me this, or is this an ongoing message she's delivering, or what? Have you heard that?
This is a common refrain from the councilwoman. She's often said that she thinks that the mayor spends too much time out of town. He's traveling too much. He's not in City Hall enough. He's not hands-on enough. He's not out in the neighborhoods. Again, these are common complaints that she's alleged against this sitting administration over a period of time. These are not new complaints from her. They're certainly not just emerging with her campaign announcement either. You know, Peduto's supporters will tell you that his time spent out of town is dedicated to drumming up resources for the city, and that the city has seen a lot more funding, a lot more attention, a lot more recognition because of the amount of time that the mayor spends on the road.
What other issues is she raising, though, or failures on the part of the incumbent?
I can't believe she didn't mention bike lanes.
Wait.
Because she was upset during the debate that bike lanes didn't come up as an issue. And jokingly, after it was over, she came out and said, it's a fix. This debate was fixed. I think that I don't know that what Mrs. Harris is running is sort of an issues driven thing. Right. I mean, she's not talking about here's my proposal for a better way to manage the Water and Sewer Authority. I think a lot of it is sort of an identity driven thing. He's this kind of the travel is part of that. He's this kind of elite sort of East End guy. He's not in the communities enough. He's jet setting around, you know, the country when he should be kind of taking care of filling potholes back at home or whatever. I feel like it's a lot, and he's too much into these bike lanes, which also appeal to sort of East End elitists or whatever. I think there's a lot of that kind of identity, sort of class identity kind of stuff going on there, and that's really, she's kind of campaigning more on that sort of resentment, I think, than on a particular policy platform.
Absolutely. And some of her first remarks at the debate on Wednesday night, Councilwoman Harris said potholes. Like we weren't even 10 minutes into the debate on Wednesday night, and she was bringing up potholes.
Is that a hot button issue with people?
I mean, obviously, streets and potholes have been a big issue in the Pittsburgh area for a lot of years. And I do think in other races as well. I'm also writing about the City Council 4th District in the South Hills. That too has been an issue. There is, are we going to focus on these sort of day to day basic needs, or do we talk about these sort of big picture items about universal pre-K education? And those dynamics do play out in and for many election cycles here have that this sense of we need to focus on these kind of very immediate neighborhood kind of concerns, and you guys are all worrying about your big pointy head elitist, you know, conversations.
Yeah, and I can tell you, so I cover City Hall. That's right. Normally what I do at the Post-Gazette. And, you know, often when we write the stories about the street that's crumbling, the hillside that's falling into someone's backyard, maybe or maybe not because of something the city did or didn't do, more often than not, those are the sorts of stories that we find gain a lot of resonance with our readers. Pittsburghers really care about those basic, fundamental, infrastructure-driven issues in their city.
When I did a sit-down with Reverend Welsh recently, he said Mayor Peduto had fallen short on addressing the need for affordable housing.
Well, I guess it ranges from 7 to 9 or even 17,000. I saw numbers of 17,000 as far as the city's concerned. I would not pinpoint the need in any specific area. I'd say we like for people to be able to live anywhere within the 90 neighborhoods.
Has this been an ongoing theme for his campaign, Chris?
Yeah, right from the outset. It's very much at the heart of what Reverend Welch is talking about as a sort of economic justice platform. And he's speaking to a concern that I think a lot of people have, which is, yeah, there are parts of this city that are growing, they're going gangbusters, East Liberty and a lot of the East End in particular. At the same time, there are places that are getting no investment whatsoever, at least that's the perception. And even in those places that are doing well, folks who are living there and been living there for a long time suddenly find themselves priced outside the market. So there's a real tension here. What is this new Pittsburgh going to be that the mayor keeps talking about, and are we going to have a place in it? And the mayor, it's very interesting to Mehdi Adam, who watched the debate, will have a feeling about this too. The mayor has been very careful to say, we need to be mindful of that. I think he's very aware that this is an area that people have a lot of concern about his administration in particular and where the city's going generally.
Absolutely. And you can see in the debate over Penn Plaza that this administration, the Peduto administration, has really taken a strong line, a very hard line on affordable housing. And it's gotten into some very public, very rancorous debates with the developer who's behind the planned redevelopment of the Penn Plaza site, where, of course, you know, more than 200 residents were relocated for more of an upmarket kind of development there in East Liberty.
We spoke with Mayor Peduto earlier this week, and he said that over the last 3+ years, he's been trying to make the city government catch up with what's happening in the city.
We have been able to change a lot of city government itself to meet the capacity of what will be needed for the future Pittsburgh and not simply for the past Pittsburgh.
So is that sort of his big picture focus? Progress, progressive, the future?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I think Mayor Peduto has it's always been characteristic of him, he's a bit of a wonk. And so sometimes when people have brought up these economic justice issues in the course of this campaign, he'll sort of give these answers that are kind of technocratic solutions or whatever. We're doing a land bank. We're doing a affordable housing trust fund. And I can detect sometimes in the audience a certain amount of frustration with all of that. He's always sort of been interested in the mechanics of government, and that's a remote issue for some people. But I think that's what's so interesting about this affordable housing issue is it is very much this is an issue people feel in their gut. And the mayor has, I think by his own acknowledgement, it's taken a long time to get to a point where he's even starting to get these structures like the housing trust fund into place to do this. And I think I think part of what he's up against is a frustration and a concern on people's part that by the time he gets a grip on this problem, it'll be too late because the market will have taken over and prices will start skyrocketing beyond what a government can even do.
So a reminder, no incumbent Pittsburgh mayor seeking re-election has lost. Reverend Welch, Councilwoman Harris, they know those odds are so long against them. What are you sensing is what they're hoping to accomplish in their campaigns?
Even if they see the odds are long against them, and they must, it appears that both of them at least want to try to influence the direction of the mayor's office simply by running. There's been a perception that Reverend Welch has sort of pushed some of the conversation around the mayoral race to the left, has made sure that this race focuses more on some of the social issues, some of the issues of inequities in the city. And meanwhile, Councilwoman Harris, she has, with her kind of retail politicking approach to this race, has kind of brought more of a focus to the day-to-day, very mechanical, practical operations of city government. And we're having conversations about potholes that we might not have had before.
Chris Potter, you get the final 30 seconds.
I think that's all true. Darlene Harris, I sometimes think of her as kind of the honey badger of Pittsburgh politics. She just don't care. I mean, I think she's out there saying the things she wants to say. I don't get the sense that she is necessarily convinced that she's going to win. With Reverend Welch, you know, I asked him, I said, you know, is your intention to be pushing the mayor to the left? And he said, somebody else asked me that too. And I said, if the left is where the exit is, then that's exactly the direction I want to push Bill Peduto.
Chris Potter covers politics for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Adam Smeltz is the City Hall reporter for the Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a year ago, medical marijuana was legalized in Pennsylvania. But how close are we to implementing the system, and are doctors ready to participate in the process? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Athletes and medical marijuana executives from across the country are in Pittsburgh today for a two-day World Medical Cannabis Conference and Expo focused on sports and using medical marijuana to treat chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, the brain disease encountered especially by football players after repeated blows to the head. Also this week marked the first anniversary of the passage of legislation to legalize medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. We're going to discuss the progress toward the production and sale of medical marijuana in the state with Ben Schmidt, health reporter for the Tribune Review. He joins us by phone. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And in studio is Charlie Deitch, editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome back, Charlie.
Thank you.
Okay, gentlemen, as I mentioned, it's been a year since medical marijuana was legalized in Pennsylvania. Drugs still not available for prescription in the Commonwealth. Governor Tom Wolf says the process is on track. Let's recap about this process. So a year ago, it's legalized. What's the end date, and what are some of the key steps along the way? Ben, should we start with you?
Yeah, so some of the key steps along the way was they put out applications, they being the state, I'm sorry, for potential growers, processors, and dispensaries. And I think that application process closed on March 20th. So right now we're in a holding pattern waiting to see whose applications are granted. I believe in the phase one rollout, there will be 27 dispensaries and 12 growers and processors throughout the state. So the competition is heavy and steep.
Yeah, I actually have I've spoken to a couple of folks who are in play for the processor licenses, and they've already invested a ton of time and money, and it's so competitive, everybody thinks they have the inside track, but they've invested so much already. To not get that license would be pretty crippling for them as businessmen.
Now, you mentioned 12 and 27. Is this sort of a conservative number starting, or is there any sense that they could expand either of those categories?
I think they'll expand. I think that it took so long to get any type of a law passed, to get the Republicans in the House to actually bring it to the floor. I think that they were willing to make some concessions, but I think that ultimately, I think it will grow to be in line with the need for this medication across the state.
Ben, is it a wait and see to see what sort of demand there might be with the potential of expansion, do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Charlie. I think it will expand. I think they're just starting off slowly because they want to see how it works. And actually, they've been praised by some of the experts I've interviewed, probably same people Charlie's spoken to, that have said it's good to start small and just get a handle on it because it's so brand new. And I think in some of the other states, it's been out of control initially with just too many dispensaries. So they are kind of playing it in a conservative manner.
As I mentioned, there was almost a celebration earlier this week, and the governor said that he expects the permits will begin to be allocated over the next few months.
The first round, I think there will be two rounds. First round should be all awarded by sometime in June.
All right, so we have permits for growers, processors, and dispensers. I want to get to, do communities have any say on whether they want dispensaries in their neighborhoods or not? Is there any room in this is the state seeking input? Do we know? Ben, do you know?
I know that there are some communities where either the borough councils or city councils voted along the lines whether to set them up to be properly zoned for these. But again, as I said earlier, there's going to be so few initially that I think they're going to be awarded to places that have that in place. For example, McKeesport is one that really wants this. And Charlie had mentioned speaking with some companies that have invested a lot of money. There's a company, Pure Pen, that is trying to set up in McKeesport. And I know that they're really hopeful that they can get an application granted. And I know that I think McKeesport Council voted unanimously to approve this. They really want this. They want this industry.
Let me follow up with the McKeesport thing. Did they have to vote, or was this just sort of a sense of McKeesport Council saying, yeah, we like the idea, or was that necessary?
I think they did have to have zoning approval. I don't know if Charlie wants to back me up on that or
not. Yeah, I believe that's true.
Okay, so I wanted to get the idea of the community, so the zoning approval, but just sort of residents. Our Liz Reed, WESA reporter, she attended a community meeting in Lawrenceville in November, I believe it was, and a applicant to run a dispensary, a man, a veteran, asked for the community meeting to say, hey, look, I want to know your concerns. I do want to locate one in your community. Have we heard of any others? I asked Liz, and she said she hadn't.
Braddock, I know that John Fetterman in Braddock is being very proactive. He's actually working with, the name escapes me, but he's working with a company already who are looking to put a grow operation and a dispensary in Braddock. Again, for him, for Fetterman, it's another way to try and bring business and economic growth to Braddock. And so it doesn't surprise me because John Fetterman obviously is a very progressive politician. So it makes sense, but that's one community. And I believe also Findlay Township also, I believe, has sort of made some, they've made some zoning changes to also welcome some of these businesses, I believe.
I think there's even more than that. I think I read, is it Swickley Township did the same thing recently? There's a bunch of them that are doing this. And back again to the McKeesport, I mean, the numbers we're being told is that this could create up to 75 jobs, and the lowest wage would be $14.15 an hour. So, this could really help the community, according to Pure Penn and the McKeesport government.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the rollout of the legalization of medical marijuana in Pennsylvania with Charlie Deach. He's editor of Pittsburgh City Paper, and Ben Schmidt, health reporter for the Tribune Review. Ben, on Thursday, the Department of Health selected a vendor, MJ Freeway, I believe, to implement an electronic tracking system. What is their charge? What are they supposed to be doing?
So going off the top of my head, I believe they're supposed to just track the growing and use of medical marijuana from seed all the way to the time it's processed and actually given to patients.
Is this like quality control?
It's almost a I think that's one way to put it. I think it's almost to just really keep a record of everything that's happening and have a tracking system in place. And apparently they do this all over the country and beyond.
A second part of this, I believe, that the Secretary of Health said was a registry for patients and caregivers and practitioners to participate in the program.
That's correct. I think that was one of the main points that was put into the law that got so many other people behind it, I think, finally to get it passed, is they wanted to make sure that doctors were in on this, and they wanted to make sure that the right people, quote-unquote, were getting the medical marijuana. In fact, they went out of their way, I think, if you read that legislation, they went out of their way to make sure, okay, we're going to have medical marijuana, but we don't want anybody having fun with this. I mean, there are provisions against smoking it. There are other provisions just to make sure that it's not used for any other purpose. So I think that also speaks to what may or may not happen for recreational legalization down the road for Pennsylvania.
And that maybe those kind of restrictions maybe help get the thing passed in the first place?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so, but in the meantime, and of course, some of the biggest advocates for legalizing medical marijuana have been parents of children who suffer severe and multiple seizures, many, many seizures a day. In the meantime, though, I mean, this is a long process. In the meantime, they are able to access medical marijuana from out of state?
Yes.
That's true. Sorry.
The state has a safe harbor program in which there are some providers that can provide medical marijuana to parents and sick children in this state. So while our program is being rolled out, they still have access to the medication. Ben probably has a little more information on that than I do.
No, that's correct. And I think the information we received today from the state was there are 226 applicants who have been approved for safe harbor medical marijuana use. The one caveat is you have to go in across state lines and somehow bring that back yourself. But they are allowing that to happen. And there was some concern about, are we breaking the law by bringing it over the state line? Possibly, yes. But it's still being done and approved.
So you're allowed to use it to get it from a state that has it already in place, but even bringing it into the state might be illegal.
Correct.
Well, yeah, because you have federal law that's a whole. We could do a whole other segment about that, but marijuana is still a Schedule I drug according to federal law.
Right, but I think the safe harbor provision is good for these families because a lot of them were giving the medication to their kids anyway, even before the law, and they were bringing it in from out of state. And we did a feature story about a year and a half ago on a mother who was actively giving her daughter medical cannabis and just dared someone to come and stop her, and she didn't. So for those families, this is obviously the safe harbor is a great provision, but it was going to happen anyway, and I think it was starting to happen, I think, even on a larger level.
So it's legalized. Growers, distributors will be authorized, but it's up to the doctors to sort of give their approval or sign up for it. Let's hear from Dr. James Joseph. He's a member of the Pennsylvania Academy of Family Physicians. He told us that he and a lot of his colleagues aren't ready to okay it because they claim there's not enough science.
There are a lot of devils in the details that I think physicians who are not familiar with this, very appropriately so, will need to, you know, become educated before they begin changing their practice.
So, gentlemen, let me ask, so you still have to get, so the product might be there for parents, for their kids, but you still have to get an okay from a medical practitioner so you can get this? And that's another obstacle, possibly?
Correct. And you probably can't even necessarily go to your family physician unless your family physician goes through the process of being certified to actually distribute the medication. And I think Ben could probably answer this too. I believe that they have to get certified for particular conditions as well, not just an overall certification, but I believe they have to get certified for individual conditions to prescribe this for.
Ben?
Yeah, I believe there's a list of 17 conditions. And just going off the top of my head, I think some of them are digestive disorders, Crohn's and colitis, MS, among others.
Right.
Those are some of the conditions.
And the intractable seizures. Right.
Correct. Correct.
All right. So, in fact, the Pennsylvania Department of Health, I think they are still running a survey, online survey of doctors through at least the end of April, asking doctors, would you prescribe it? How would you prescribe it? So there still seems to be some uncertainty about whether doctors are buying into the effectiveness. Ben?
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think that this train is already pretty far down the track, and I think there will be doctors that you'll be able to find. There's going to be some apprehension among some at the beginning, but I don't think you're stopping this, and I think it will be available for the people who need it in Pennsylvania. One thing we did touch on briefly is, Charlie mentioned it, you can't actually smoke leaf form in Pennsylvania under the medical marijuana law. You have to take it either in a vape form, some sort of tincture, an oil, things along those lines. So you can't right now, under this law, smoke it as you see done in other states.
And we're going to give the final word to Charlie about this ongoing process. And do you think we are on track to get it by the timetable?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we hear about the doctors who are against this now, but there are so many doctors that testified during this process who fought for this along with their patients who desperately need this medication. So, yeah, I think we're on track to, by 2018, to have this program in place, and then where it goes from there is anybody's guess.
Charlie Deach is editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Ben Schmidt is health reporter for the Tribune Review. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the Penguins submit update plans for the development of the 24 acres where the former Civic Arena sat. A look at the long, ongoing process. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, the Pittsburgh Penguins submitted a letter of intent to the Sports and Exhibition Authority and the Urban Redevelopment Authority to begin the first phase of the development of the former Civic Arena site. The arena was demolished 5 years ago. Joining us in studio are two reporters who have been covering this long process. Bob Botter from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Thank you.
And freelance reporter and host of the broadcast podcast, Kim Lyons. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay, according to the Post-Gazette, the Penguins hope to begin construction of the first 255 units of residential development in several months to a year. About 20% is supposed to be affordable housing units rather than the market rate. A residential component, is that one thing that's been consistent through the years of the plans, that residential component might be the first part of any development? Has that been consistent?
Well, it's always been a part of. It's always been part of the conversation, and I think it's something that the residents in that neighborhood want very much, to make sure there's not just housing but affordable housing. So it's a tricky, you know, line to walk. They have to make sure that they're meeting all the requirements that's going to get a developer to develop the site, but also, you know, they have some commitments that they've made to this neighborhood to make sure that they have housing that's affordable for people who live in the neighborhood to potentially use.
Well, let me follow up with Bob here on that affordable housing aspect. I mentioned that 20% supposed to be, but what's beyond those facts, if you would?
Well, the Penguins have said that there is a $5 million funding gap that they need to close in order to provide that 20% affordable housing. And so the city, with help from Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, have been lobbying the state for low-income housing tax credits that they hope are going to fill that gap. So they need to come up with $5 million somewhere before they can move ahead with the affordable housing portion of that residential phase of the development.
Do we know if they've got that yet?
They have not. The state will not announce the allocations till later this year, and there's no guarantee that Pittsburgh will receive what they need.
Okay. I mentioned that the demolition of the arena began in September of 2011, completed in March of 2012, 5 years ago. Both of you, if you would, what have been the key holdups for actually groundbreaking, or even the announcement of when we might break ground? What do you see as the key developments or key holdups?
There's just been a lot of false starts, I think, with projects that they've had in mind, and I think they've been very careful about, they have, a commitment to the neighborhood, to residents there who want to see this developed in a certain way that's inclusive, that doesn't leave them out of the equation. But it's very tricky to make sure that you're pleasing all the parties all of the time. That's what sort of hampered a lot of the progress moving forward, is that there are, you know, commitments that they have to make to people in the neighborhood, as well as to fulfill any, you know, tax credits they receive or any other kind of, you know, incentives that are attached to the any project that goes there.
And you have to remember this started under the Ravenstahl administration. So there's been a change in mayoral administrations since this since the arena went down. And so the Peduto administration had to get up to speed, and the mayor has said they had to work out an agreement with the Hill District community stakeholders before they could even start. And that took them better part of 2014. They had a setback with U.S. Steel that had committed to build an office building on the site and then pulled out because of an economic downturn. And you had things like that go on throughout this project.
We have a question from David on Twitter wanting to know if the Penguins are using the design from the founding architect of, I believe it's Big. They presented 28-acre master plan for the Lower Hill District in 2015. It included residential units and retail space. Do we know if the architect has been decided upon?
I know that Big is still on board with them. Now, whether their plans have changed, they have not announced any change in plans.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the Penguins were supposed to develop 10% of the site each year, about 2+ acres. Or was that supposed to be given back to the community or what? Because obviously they have not developed 10% of the site. So what happened? Why were they not held to it?
That's the sort of the million-dollar question, I think, is that, you know, how do they again, keep the commitment to the neighborhood and keep the commitments that they've made for developing portions of the site as they go along? How are they going to? There's a lot of commitments that have to be met here under any project that goes in there. So, it's there's so many factors to weigh in that it's almost this sort of catch 22 of you can't get anything done until you agree with the neighbors in the neighborhood, but the neighbors in the neighborhood have to, you know, get on board with moving things forward. So, but they, you know, they're rightly so are a little gun shy of any, you know, project coming in there. They've seen a lot go through, a lot of plans come up that haven't come to fruition. This is a neighborhood that's, you know, suffered from some of the development that's happened there in the past. And so I think they're wary, and rightly so, of any project that comes in there. So getting all these pieces into place is certainly a challenge that, you know, I don't think there's really good any good answers of, you know, here's X that will solve all the problems. It's certainly not. I mean, the Penguins, the developer still has to buy some of the land in order to do some of this work. So,
well, speaking,
it's so much, yeah.
Well, speaking of buying land, are they using their own money, Bob?
No. The state put a pot of money together for them to be used for the purchase of the property.
So the Penguins are going to buy land. They're going to buy a couple of some acreage here for this first phase, and they're using state money to buy it.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the correct response, by the way. It's sort of it's a bit of a head scratcher all around. Every sort of phase of this is dependent on another thing. We're crossing our fingers we get these independent, these low-income housing credits. We're sort of hoping that we'll be able to fill that gap. We're hoping we'll be able to buy the land. There's an awful lot of hope and crossed fingers, but it's a difficult project to move forward, and I think they're really not anywhere closer to getting it moved forward than they were until they get these tax credits. It's really still very much up in the air, I think.
Okay, well, we only have about 4 minutes left, unfortunately, but I want to get to several questions. And as far as the delays and not using the 10% or forfeiting it, Bob, there's been extensions. The Penguins have asked for extensions. Is one of the complicating factors they've asked for extensions from two different authorities?
No, yes, I guess they do have to get backing up. The Sports and Exhibition Authority owns most of the 28 acres. The URA owns a portion of the 28 acres up near Crawford Street. And so they've successfully gotten extensions on both of those properties from those authorities at and they're paying $75,000 for each extension.
Okay. Of course, U.S. Steel, a possible headquarters for U.S. Steel, was considered, they consider that as an anchor in that area. That fell apart. Has that caused any delay to this?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's been a significant delay that it really, you know, was sort of everyone was very hopeful. It was a local company. It was very exciting that they were going to have the potential to do this. And then they were not able, they just decided it wasn't financially feasible for them to do. So that definitely set back any other progress in the development in that neighborhood, because I think it was seen as kind of the anchor to any other development up there. And when that fell apart, that really, I think, everyone sort of had to scramble to figure out how to make it continue to move it forward.
And I know the Penguins have hopes. David Morehouse told me last year that they were talking with three significant companies about locating headquarters on that property. They haven't said anything more about that since then, but at that time, they were talking, according to Morehouse, to companies.
Is the sense those companies might be waiting to see, all right, let's get the first phase going, or what?
Let's see if we win the cup this year. I'm not sure. I don't think that could hurt.
I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. We have just about a minute and a half left. I want to get a sense from both of you in this last minute and a half of, as you've covered this story, what are the feelings? What are there frustrations? What are the feelings, hopes from the community surrounding this site? Kim, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think they're wary. And I think that, you know, again, like I said,
wary or wary?
Wary. That okay. Anything that goes in there, they want to feel like they're a part of, and they want to feel like they understand fully what's going on and all the pieces. It's so just this conversation here, it's so complex, and there's so many parties involved that they're wary of any plan. I don't think anyone is feeling any sigh of relief up there. I think that there's a lot of folks who are waiting to hear and waiting to see something actually happen before they're going to relax a little bit and feel like they're being heard.
And we get the final 35 seconds for you, Bob.
Well, I've heard a lot of frustrations from Hill District groups. The Hill Consensus Group for example, has been highly critical of the parking, the parking revenue that the Penguins receive from, you know, the lots up there. And they're frustrated that, that it's not moving along. They have hopes for jobs on that site. They have hopes for minority businesses on that site. Yep. And job training programs on that site.
Bob Botter is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Kim Lyons is a freelance reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Kevin.
And one final note, we say goodbye today to Marcus Charleston, WESA producer and reporter. Marcus is leaving to join KJZZ in Phoenix. 9 months ago, Marcus and I were given the challenge, the opportunity to create a new program, a news roundup show. September 2nd, The Confluence debuted under his guidance. So Marcus, thanks and good luck, my friend. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.